tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This is the evening of the coming together of a few different occasions, being a full moon night. This is a time for taking the precepts and Dhamma talk. Also, this is a Saturday evening, and so get either two for the price of one, or one shot instead of two this week. Also, today is the autumnal equinox, the end of the summer, beginning of autumn, happens today. We also have three former anagarikas in the visited by three of our former novices this weekend. An auspicious occasion all round. Oftentimes people wonder how it works with coming to live in a monastery or joining a monastery. Sometimes when they meet people, meet nuns or monks, they the first impression is that they might get is that we sort of came out of the pod this way, and that we were sort of born as little monklets, equipped with a robe in the maternity ward, got the right hairdo, and just sort of wrapped up in brown from the beginning, but it's an interesting way that Buddhist monasticism works, particularly in the Theravada tradition, and that as it's practiced in Thailand and Burma, and carries the same spirit from the time of the Buddha, which is that a monastery is endeavors to be an environment where people are encouraged to live, to function in a way that is respectful of these ethical standards. This is taking the eight precepts together. This defines the way of conduct in a monastery. And essentially, a monastery is a sanctuary. It endeavors to be an environment that sustains this quality of conduct, and also a quality of direction, like a spiritual direction towards the realization of the truth of the way things are. And it tries to sustain an atmosphere, an environment that encourages that quality of awakening, of being able to focus the mind and really look into the heart of life as we experience it, as we live it, as we are it, as it exists around us, to look in, to see how it works, and to bring the heart into accord with that reality. So rather than monks and nuns being kind of separate species, is this way from birth, it's more of an environment, just as some of us live here, others have just come for the evening, others are here for a few days. It's an environment that all people are welcome to come and participate in, for whether it's for an hour or for a day, a week, a month, a year, a lifetime. And that it's an environment that we can, ideally, is something that helps us to learn, that encourages us to teach ourselves, to be able to study the way life works, and for that studying, that exploration, and that training of the heart to really benefit us, and thereby benefiting, you know, all people. So that you know, those sometimes it's you know, we have a kind of discriminative function of our minds. We create we easily create firm divisions, like, you know, monastics are like this and lay people are like that, and this is sort of in the monastery, that's outside the monastery. But one of the things that I found very helpful and inspiring about this system that you find in the Theravada countries is that it's very much a permeable membrane. The monastery's walls are not really walls. You know, the gate is always, well, there might be walls, but the gate is always open. You know, just, we have these wonderful retaining walls. You know, the monastery has walls, but no gate. So what this means is that people are welcome to come and participate in this environment, and to use this environment as long as it's helpful and in the ways that it can be supportive to our lives. But when it's time to move on, whether it's to go back after an evening here, or after a week, or a month, or a year, or decade, or not to leave, it's up to us as individuals and the circumstances of our lives, our nature, our character. So the point of coming to a monastery, taking the precepts, and, you know, visiting on an observance day like today, or coming to listen to Dhamma teachings, coming to practice meditation, is in some respects to create wholesome influences in our life, to create wholesome karma. Yeah, it's the tea time, talking with a few people, that this subject came up, the asking about the nature of karma. And there can be a lot of confusion. There's some sort of different ways that the word gets used in English, and some very colourful misconceptions float around and intermingle. But in the Buddhist understanding, there's a particular way of looking at what karma is, and how it functions, and how we cultivate wholesome karma, and why. So oftentimes karma in English is used as a synonymous with fate or destiny. Oh, it's my karma. You know, a kind of excuse or reasoning why, you know, you get stuck in the traffic, or why you got flung out of your job, or you won the big prize. You say, oh, it's my karma. But the Buddhist understanding of the word is not so fatalistic, or not, certainly not synonymous with this idea of fate or chance or destiny. Essentially, the word karma just means action. It just means, you know, action that's based on volition. And then it also, in a way, it's that term, karma, is a shorthand for karma vipaka. And vipaka means the fruit or the result. So when we say karma in Buddhist teachings, what we generally mean is action and the results of those actions, the cause and the effect. So that it's really a very simple, straightforward, practical thing. It's nothing sort of mysterious, there's no sort of woo-woo element about it. It's kind of mysterious, you know, etheric quality floating around, you know, my karma, which is being guided by strings being pulled from above or someplace. But it's much more like the law of physics, like Newton's laws of motion. You know, there's an action and a result. You know, each action has an equal and opposite reaction. So this is what we mean by karma, is when action is taken on a basis of volition, when we make a decision, when we choose to do something, when some action happens or something is experienced, then there's an effect as a result to that action. So when we come to a monastery and we train as monastics, or we just visit for an evening or come for a few days, there's an intention there. There's an effort being made. Action is being taken on our own initiative, our own volition. We're here to do something, to get something, to bring about an effect. So we're creating karma in that respect. We're bringing that into being in order to bring about a certain effect. So we are, say, listening to a Dhamma talk or practicing meditation in order to help us to see more clearly, to understand the nature of our own being more clearly, to help our life be more peaceful, more harmonious, to live more fully and to learn how to create less dukkha, less suffering, less difficulty in our lives. Now we do inherit a vast complex of effects from past actions and past experiences. So one of the questions that someone was asking at tea time today is, like, you know, if we've had all these past lifetimes, then surely there's a massive amount of karma that we've got to work out. And so there must be this huge backlog of causes, and all of their effects are sort of queuing up to happen. So that's one element of question that we can have. Also, one of the teachings that the Buddha gave was that within our lifetime, the experiences that we have, the different things that arise, the different things that manifest in our life, only 1/7 of those are caused by events or actions that have happened in this lifetime, and the other 6/7 have come from previous lifetimes. So, you know, some people don't like the idea of previous lives, but certainly this is a very key element of the Buddha's teaching. And so just for the sake of giving some explanation this evening, I'll just presume that this life that we're experiencing is part of a whole cascade of different lifetimes that have come into being and affect each other over centuries, millennia, beginningless time. So you might think that, you know, if all of these causes have been set in motion, then how can they ever be wound up? But it's also, in terms of a Buddhist understanding, it's not like a kind of strict mathematical linear relationship that exists from the things that we do or the things that we experience. It's not as though everything that's been brought into being has to kind of play itself out for eternity. But far more, the Buddha's approach was, which would be a kind of fatalistic approach. And people even in the time of the Buddha had that kind of philosophy that it was simply a matter of holding steady while your karma ran out, and then when all the karma ran out, then you would live happily ever after in some kind of eternal bliss. And the Buddha said, you know, this is a wrong view, it doesn't actually work that way. Or we might have the view that, since there's an ultimate reality and the true nature of all beings is pure and perfect, then surely, you know, all the karma that's gone on doesn't really matter anyway, and that when the karma that's been created wears out, or if we that sooner or later that's just going to run down, and that pure nature will sort of shine through on its own, or that that we have a sort of set number of rebirths in, sort of woven into us, and that when the assigned number runs out, then boom, everything will be fine. The Buddha used the analogy like saying that like it's a ball of string that unrolls and unravels, and when it finally reaches its end, then that's the end of being, and the heart is released. And so none of the, and there's many other different philosophies I won't go into, but one of the things that's interesting about the Buddha's teaching is that it's not a particularly, it's not really big on, the Buddha wasn't really big on consolation. That sort of sense of it, it'll all end happily ever after. It's like, well, yes and maybe no. It might not end happily at all. It might not end at all. And so sometimes people can find this somewhat chilling, because we like the idea of, well, it'll all work out in the end. We like that promise of, well, no matter how much I screw it up or how bad things get, it's going to end happily, isn't it? We'll all go off to heaven or nirvana, or we'll all dissolve into the uncreated, won't we? And it can be a bit of a sobering, a chilling news when we come across the Buddha Dharma, when the Buddha makes it clear, like, well, not necessarily the end. When we say in the end, we can be talking about a long, 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 long time, and even then, not necessarily. Yeah, does it come to an end? That's why the word samsara means endless wandering, and so that. Whereas many religious philosophies point to this idea of a sort of, the kingdom of God or some kind of paradise where we'll all go to and live happily ever after eventually, the Buddha pointed out that, well, it can just go on and on and on and on until there's real understanding, until the heart is liberated. It can just go on and on and on and on and on. That's why samsara, it's endlessness. So this might be pretty off-putting, or something designed to ruin your Saturday evening. It's not your entire weekend. But if you look closely and we kind of examine that feeling, part of us is a bit shocked or upset or disappointed, or like, oh, I really like happy endings. But then part of us is also, if we really look at the heart, it's like, is actually relieved. I say, yeah, it is that way. Why should it all end happily? why should that be that kind of guarantee? And so what the Buddha pointed to is that if we do the right thing, if we expend our effort in the right way, if we direct our attention skillfully, if we function from a right view, then it'll definitely end happily. Great, marvelous. It will be the very best that can come of a human life, of any life. It's great, marvelous. But if we don't make that right effort, if we don't direct our attention in the appropriate way, if we don't come from right view, then it's just going to go on and on and on, the endless round of rebirths. So this, I think, is a helpful truth to acknowledge. And again, Buddhist teachings are always given in the spirit of being offered for consideration, for they're not handed out as dogmatic ideas, principles that are expected to be believed in, but more just themes that are offered for reflection upon. So I just, I offer these for consideration, for reflection. But I found for myself when I first encountered this teaching that there was that sense of a disappointment of like, oh well, I wanted a guarantee here. It'd be nice to have some wonderful, inspiring religious authority promise me you know, yes, it really is, you really are going to be okay, and it really is going to end happily. But you also realize that's a very childish hope or childish sentiment, and that the realism of the teaching was actually, there was a relief in that, and also a taste of the real, like an intuition of, yeah, that feels a bit more realistic. That, yeah, there's water in the ground, there's groundwater there, but unless I dig for it, you know, I'm not going to come across it. You know, it's just, I can sit here and wait for it to just pop out of the ground. But perhaps it means I have to dig for it in order to hit the groundwater. We have to drill the well to get to the groundwater. And really, that's what the Buddha is about. It's like, yeah, the truth is there. The water is in the ground. But if we don't make the effort, then it's going to stay there. And it's not going to just pop out under its own pressure. So that the Buddha tried to explain or direct the attention to how karma works and the way to so you get digging for how to get down to the groundwater and to access it. And yeah, as I said, there were many views that existed in his time, just as they do today, and the idea that maybe, you know, bad karma is burnt off by painful feeling, and then the more painful feeling that you experience, then the more, you know, your bad karma you burnt away. So, you know, self-mortification is not very big in religious circles, Buddhist meditation circles. People not into sort of starvation and beds of nails these days, but we do a lot of retreats and go through the sort of the tortures of 10-day retreats or longer retreats, weekend retreats, the same kind of diligently plugging away, following our breath, hour after hour, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, following the breath, doing walking meditation, you know, keeping the precepts, you know, doing insight practice, you know, very diligently and with great sincerity, plugging away. And oftentimes with a completely unconscious belief that, you know, we wouldn't even phrase it that way, but the belief that, well, I'm doing my practice, I'm developing good qualities here, I'm burning off my obstructions, and sooner or later there'll be the breakthrough, just because of, you know, I'm following the formula, I'm doing the right thing, I've been hanging off the end of my nose for years now. Yeah, I must have followed 84,000 million inhalations and exhalations. I must be nearly there. That's rather like, you know, if you've been on driving on I-5, and you think, well, I must be near, I've been driving for hours and hours and hours, at least 15 hours, I must be near Los Angeles. But if you've been driving north instead of south, you're going to be near Vancouver rather than LA. So it's not just a matter of driving, it's not just a matter of putting forth the effort, it's putting forth the effort in a skillful fashion. So the Buddha tried to counteract these views of, say, just, you know, just because of doing work with a skillful intention, that's not necessarily it. Or the idea that if I'm experiencing difficulty or pain or just making effort, that I'm burning off the obstructions. It's not necessarily so. You know, there's a putting forth of effort, but also that putting forth of effort in the right way. You know, what's going to actually bear fruit for us? What's going to really lead us to the goal to free the heart? So in this respect, he certainly encouraged the development of wholesome karma. you know, taking the eight precepts, this is and endeavoring to live by those, you know, coming for the observance day, you know, keeping the eight precepts for the day and the night, and through to the next morning, living in the monastery, living on the precepts here, practicing meditation, listening to the teachings, and studying the Dhamma and practicing. These are all very, you know, wholesome karmas. They're wholesome actions to cultivate kindness, unselfishness, right speech, and gentleness, to let go of the habits of greed, of reactivity, of fearfulness, of aggression. These are all very noble and wholesome kinds of karma. And but those efforts on their own are not enough. We use the environment of a monastery or a retreat. We establish this kind of conduct not because it's intrinsically good, not because it's absolutely good. You know, the Buddha looked at wholesome action, virtue, and so forth, and meditation techniques. These are conditioned qualities. They are aspects of the conditioned world. They're skillful means, upaya, that can lead us to a wholesome end. So the reason why the Buddha encouraged wholesome karma in acting in these ways is because that is basically because goodness helps to clear the mind where badness or unwholesomeness clouds the mind. It's very simple. It's like, just like the laws of physics. If you want to see clearly, you need to let the smoke out of the room. You know, if we clean your glasses. But if the room is full of smoke, or our glasses are kind of covered in dust and muck, then we won't be able to see clearly. So that goodness is not intrinsically good. It just it enables us to see what's going on, to know what's going on, how life works more directly. That's all. So that what this means is that if I am acting unselfishly, if I'm acting in a moral way, if I'm refraining from lying or backbiting, if I'm not invading people's privacy or kind of taking their things or making passes at them or kind of acting aggressively, then I don't have to either live with the reactions that I'm getting from people because of that behavior. I'm not having to remember carry that around within me. You know, if I act generously, if I act with kindness and gentleness, then that brings an intrinsic brightness to the heart. The heart is unburdened. It feels naturally joyful. There's nothing to regret. So because of that lack of regret, then there's a physical mental ease, and concentration comes much easier. The mind settles on the moment, the attention settles on the moment that much more easily and readily. When I'm filled with regret or tension because I've lied to somebody or I've said something hurtful to them, and then I'm defending myself, I'm, you know, afraid that they're going to fight back, or they're going to discover that I've taken this from them, or I've hurt, you know, I've done this or that is kind of hurtful or not trustworthy, then of course the mind is tense and heavy and clouded, burdened. So this is really how one should understand, you know, the wholesome and unwholesome, kusala and akusala in the Buddha's teaching. Wholesome karma, unwholesome karma, good karma, bad karma. It's not to be seen as being intrinsically good or intrinsically bad. There's nothing absolute about it. It's simply that bad karma, you know, unwholesome action, clouds the picture, burdens the heart, clogs up the system. And wholesome karma unclogs it, clarifies the awareness, unburdens the heart, just makes it easier to see how things are. Now with that, the purpose of coming to a monastery or coming on retreat or establishing these qualities, then it's not just a matter of the immediate effects of things we do in the present, but as I was saying, there's an awful lot of backlog, you know, with these the karma of these you know, many, the other sixth sevenths of the whole picture, this uncountable succession of lives and all of the resonances and reverberations of actions that have been followed, actions that have been taken, or experiences that have occurred. There's a whole pile, a whole flood of different influences there. So, and many of those might be very painful, you know, unskillful actions, memories of stupid things that we did when we were younger, or just painful things that happened to us for whatever reason, known or unknown. Yeah, we remember all of that. It shows up. It forms a kind of texture in our life, in our world. But when we establish a practice, a way of living that is based on wholesomeness and clarifies the heart in this way, then as those kind of negative or painful or colorful, intense resonances arrive from as effects from past actions, then we have the greatest possibility for understanding them, for knowing them clearly, for seeing them for what they are, and for, in a way, letting those effects fade out and not give rise to new causes. When we experience something arises, some kind of memory from the past or some sort of emotional reaction, what we're experiencing there is an effect of a past cause. So in the present moment, it's up to us what we do with that. If the mind is confused and clouded and reactive, then we just suppress it, we run away from it, we grab hold of it, we believe in it, we wallow in it, we justify it, we blame somebody for it, and so on and so on and so on. If the heart is uncluttered, if it is open and alert, then when such a feeling arises, some sort of effect from a past action or habit appears, then there's a chance to understand it. So I was just saying how just this morning I was sitting here before the meal and I noticed this kind of negative reaction or some painful, tense emotional quality there. And then just seeing what that was associated with. I think, oh, isn't that interesting? You know, what is this strange feeling? Is this kind of tense, heavy, frightened mood? This texture of feeling. And so then, I looked at that and explored it. That's just to figure out or to look at. Well, what does this remind me of? What does this feel like? And I remembered it was a feeling that I could remember as far back as being 6 or 7 years old, in certain circumstances. And I'd have that feeling that, oh, that it comes from there. It's just like that feeling from when I was in grade school, or when I was 6 or 7 years old, 8 years old. It feels like that. So then I could feel this urge of then just wanting to push that aside or think about something else or just get pulled into it and start believing in what it was encouraging me to be worried about or caught up in. And instead, there was just the effort to look at it just as a feeling. Well, actually, right now, it's not a pleasant feeling. It's like a toothache or a sore leg or feeling overheated. But it is. It's actually just a feeling. That's all it is. It's a feeling, tense and heavy, But it is just a feeling. I don't have to push it away. I don't have to believe in it. I don't have to distract my mind from it. I don't have to do anything with it. It's just, you know, there's, you know, a series of perceptions. They gave, you know, they trigger this association. There's this mood here. Feels like this. And you could sense that kind of little child, sort of childlike reaction of that kind of that sort of age, being a young child, feeling that kind of mood, and then just letting it sit there and holding it in that quality of awareness. And then within less than a minute, 30, 40 seconds, it just had lived its life and faded out, and it was gone. Nothing left. So this is I'm not saying it won't arise again, but it was very interesting to see how when we take the trouble, we make the effort to receive the effects of past karma, like, you know, maybe for a lifetime or many lifetimes, that's how this heart has reacted to those kinds of perceptions or experiences or expectations. A feeling threatened or imposed upon or anxious. That it's always just been either believed in and wallowed in, or pushed away, or projected onto somebody, rather than just being known. And we can see that when we take the trouble just to know it and hold that those feelings in full awareness, that cause that was created has its effect, that effect wears out, and no new cause is created on the basis of it. Because the reason why there's rebirth, the endless wandering, the endless cycles, is that very reactivity towards that kind of feeling, believing in it, pushing it away, denying it, etc., that's just building a cause on that old effect. After that, that pattern has come into being, we don't just let it fade out and disappear. We reinvigorate it. It becomes a cause for another cycle. It becomes another cause, and then it has its effect, and around and around and around and around we go. So this is how we let karma end, in a way. We see the more we fully establish awareness, quality of wisdom, fully knowing experience, then no matter how much shows up, what sort of texture it is, whether it's, you know, the painful experience as I'm describing here, or something very pleasant, you know, the delightful results of our past actions. If we're a kind and generous person, then people come to us laden with smile, you know, wreathed in smiles and laden with gifts and kindness and warmth. But even so, we can, even though that's a pleasant karmic result, we can still make a meal of that and believe in that. Say, oh, I am a wonderful person because all these people love me. And then become, you know, totally enmeshed in that and dependent upon that. So it's not just a matter of bitter experiences, there can be sweet ones too. But the more that we fully establish a heart in this quality of wisdom and knowing, then no matter what shows up, pleasant, painful, neutral, the results of this lifetime's actions or 10,000, 100,000 lifetimes' actions, they're all in a way dissolved in the same pool. They all can recede into the same space. There's no limit to the amount of old karmic patterns and forms and resonances that can dissolve into that space of awareness, like a black hole. You know, there's no limit to what the amount of matter that can be poured into a black hole, and the black hole never gets filled up. It just, you know, swallows it all without being limited by what the heart takes in. So this doesn't mean to say, and often people might think of like this kind of phrase like ending karma or winding up all my karma. It's perhaps not such a skillful way of talking, because it can seem like then, you know, what does that mean? Is this, are we supposed to sort of suddenly lose all of our personality, or what's that like? Do we just sort of become a kind of bland person, or a sort of a neutralized being of some kind? But it, the way that it works is that obviously we still have bodies, the personalities still function. Those karmic patterns are still there, you know, still the unpaid bills keep rolling in. Even someone like the Buddha in his own lifetime was receiving the results of past actions. The body itself is the result of past karma. And even someone as exalted as the Buddha, he still experienced the painful results of past actions. One time when he had a headache for 3 days, a really piercing, terrible headache. And then Ananda, in his usual attentive way, was sort of fussing and fretting and trying to find the right medicine and medical treatment and help for the Buddha. And the Buddha said, you know, Ananda, there's nothing that can be done. And he described how, he says, you know, in a previous lifetime when I was a boy, I caught a fish in the pond in the village. And after I caught the fish, then I knocked its head on the rock 3 times to kill it. And so this is what I'm experiencing now, is the karmic result of killing that fish. So, you know, I knocked it 3 times, so I'm going to have a headache for 3 days. So don't worry, Ananda. It's just a headache. It'll pass over. So even a Buddha, you know, is going to have painful results. But then what that means is that it's up to us in each moment to be able to just receive those painful experiences into that space of knowing, of open-hearted awareness, of not blaming ourselves or blaming other people or ignoring it, evading it, identifying with it, to say, oh, well, there was this action, here's its result. A1, thus it is, it's just this way. There's no need to make anything out of it, it's just nature, the patterns of nature functioning in this fluid and open, useful way. There's no need for the heart to get entangled or upset about it. Now this is how the Buddha talked in terms of escaping from the wheel of birth and death, escaping from the cycles of samsara. That this is how the heart is released, is through this quality of wisdom, of truly seeing and knowing, looking at the whole array of our human life, looking at our personality and the people around us and the events of our life as we remember them, as they happen moment by moment, cultivating the good to help keep the picture clear, and then with the picture clear, then exercising the insight into selflessness, into uncertainty, into unsatisfactoriness. It, like, really employing the wisdom eye, opening the wisdom eye, which is able to look upon this whole range of experiences and perceptions, feelings, moods, the inner world, the outer world, to see that, you know, this is not truly and completely what I am. This is not really me. This is not mine. This is not myself. We see that, you know, the personality or our name, our identity, our personal history, all the character traits and memories, plans, ideas, these have their own patterns and shapes and modulations, but in none of them can we say is sort of truly and completely what I am. These are all relatively true, partial truths. When we say, you know, I am a man, or I am a woman, or I am American or English, or I am tall or short, or a failure or a success, or I'm an extrovert, an introvert, then anything that's attached to that I am, we look as a convenient fiction. not an absolute truth. It can't be an absolute truth. This is how the heart is released, is by recognizing that it's not that I was a man and now I'm not, or I was English or I no longer am, but saying that all along these were just costumes, masks, layers of layers of perception that come into being through our birth and the circumstances of our lives. And when we see through them clearly, we're able to use those relative truths, we're able to function with them, but be unconfused by them. So we use these kind of terms like the heart is released, or escaping from the cycle of birth and death. And then people ask, if there's no self, then who is it that's released from the cycle? But in a way, it's helpful to look at the question, the presumptions that we make when we ask that kind of question. That because if we look at it, really, the when the moment of insight comes, when we in our clear moments, we see, if we look closely and we really contemplate what's happening, it's not like actually that the heart was trapped and now it's released. It's in a way that we realize that the heart was never trapped. It was just, it appeared that way. So it's rather like when you living here at Abhayagiri about 8 in the morning, the sun comes over the ridge, or like now on this full moon night, probably. Yeah, just on cue, the moon has risen over the ridge. So the moon has broken free of the ridge top, right? So the moon has broken free, and the moon is now sailing in the clear sky. But the moon was never actually trapped by the ridge. It just looked that way because we're down here in the valley bottom. And then as you see the moon coming up, and you can see the trees silhouetted against the circle of the moon or the sun, and then, will it make it? Yes! Ta-da. Yeah, the moon has broken free. Hurrah! It's like saying, the heart has been released from the cycle of birth and death. Well, yes and no. It's like the Dhamma hasn't been released from anything. The Dhamma, the truth of the way things are, has always been totally unencumbered. It's just the view from the valley bottom was of identification with the body, the personality, and all of the kind of patterns of experience meant that the moon was obscured. And so then it's just the turning of the earth that then brings about the release of the moon. The moon can kind of sail free. The heart sails free from the cycles of birth and death because of the way it can look from the birth and death side of the picture. If we look at it from the other side, from the heart side, it's just when those clear moments come, when the heart really sees and knows fully, it's like there's this sense of, why did I ever take that seriously? What was I thinking of? Or like, how on earth could that be important, really? Isn't that amazing how utterly swept up I was in that? How convincing that little story was. Like, what was all that about? So, all of us, and these kind of insights are not alien to any of us, even if they just last for like half a second or a minute here and there. It's important for us to really notice those, to just let those be the signs by which we measure our life, rather than, real life is here in the valley bottom. So real life is sort of me and my personal history and my perceptions and my problems, and you're never going to take them away from me. Is my favorite wallow. Follow me, follow, down to the hollow, and there we will wallow. And we like that, you know, nothing like a good wallow. But the heart knows that it's, you know, that's not the whole story. So that's why we long for liberation. There's this longing for truth, the longing for freedom, because our heart knows that's its true nature, that's its reality. So there's this draw, this pull towards that. So just to let our life be informed by those moments of clarity. And just so when we do have those moments where we notice, like, why is this so important to me? Or like, isn't that amazing how, you know, so-and-so is just like completely enmeshed in that. But, you know, to the rest of us it has no meaning. Huh. Isn't it strange? And just let that resonance just find its way through. And particularly with ourselves, when something that we've been caught up in or obsessed by or excited by or frightened by, there are moments where it just falls apart. Like, you know, if I didn't ascribe the value to this, if I didn't keep pasting on this importance onto this particular feeling, what would it matter? Why would it be important? And just to let that really sink in, let that be what guides us to trust that. That in that moment, you know, albeit extraordinarily brief, the heart really does see clearly. We see through that convention, that fiction, that there's nothing there. There's nothing to get upset about, nothing to get excited about. The heart is free and awake, aware in that moment. So these are some themes to consider, and please take whatever is useful. If they're useful, and take them with you. If they're not, then just leave it all aside.